So this is the third day of our seven-day retreat here at Southern Dharma. And once again, we are using this wonderful text by the third Chan, or Zen patriarch, which, as we know, has many titles, but for this one, we'll call it Trust in Mind. So as has been talked about over these last few days, we have a choice. We can trust that aspect of our mind that sees things just as they are, without any projection, without any elaboration, without any interpretation, that just sees things as they are. Like walking up today to the meditation hall. Just so see those things that we call rocks or boulders and moss and lichen. What could be said about any of that other than to see it as it is? And to see things as they are is enough. And whether it's a boulder, a lichen, a beautiful thing in nature. By the way, do these things always have to go off? What are they? They just keep going off. It's a watch? Maybe just leave it out or don't wear it or something. I mean, it's not that it's bad. It's just not needed, is it? We don't need to know when the hour is. So again, whether it's just being able to see, and again, as I think we are aware, somehow it is easier in nature, that which is called nature. By the way, this is labeled nature, which is just a word. Words point. It is somehow easier in nature to relax enough, the mind enough, that it is willing or capable of just seeing things as they are, accepting things as they are. We don't look out here and immediately go, I like that tree, I don't like that tree get rid of, that tree keep, why don't we turn that boulder a little bit, right? If we did that, our minds would be disturbed, wouldn't they? They would be agitated. But just to come and just to accept everything just as it is, the big ones and the little ones, right? The green ones and the brown ones, the ones that grow beautifully and the ones that maybe don't grow so beautifully, if you want to judge it. But we accept the whole thing as it is. And that's why I think people like, in our crazy society, like to go to nature. In Florida, they like going to the beach because it's so simple. But the problem with that, we are relying on the external to remind us of this basic truth. That things are just what they are. Our objective as practitioners is to know that capacity of seeing things just as they are is a quality of our mind, of our awareness. And the complexities of the mind that we developed and that we develop and we constantly, internally repeat over and over again, endlessly, is simply a function of the deluded or untrained mind. Right. So the challenge is to trust this mind, not just on retreat, not just at the beach, not just in the woods, not just in the mountains, not just on our cushion, but who is brave enough to walk through life free of your likes and dislikes and your opinions and your self-identities. But when you look at the choice like that, you might say, where am I happier? Right? Am I happier when I am in that state of just being with things as they are? Or am I happier when I'm in that state of constant thinking about, judging, evaluating, comparing, worrying, ruminating, fantasizing? You know? And I say that because it is important that we reflect in that way. Deeply reflect on that way. You know, again, the Buddha said, hear the teaching and then reflect on the teaching before you practice it. Many people skip over that. They hear the teaching, sounds good, I'll practice it. And that's why their practice doesn't really go anywhere. It's on, it's off, it's back and forth. You're with it, you're not with it. You're energized, you're not energized, you're bored, you're enthusiastic. It's because that deep reflection, the Buddha said, you know, don't practice for me. Don't practice because it's the Dharma. Practice because you get it, because you've reflected on it. It makes sense to you. It concords with your experience. Only then practice it. I mean, that's an important thing that the Buddha said, and yet we skip over it. And I think that's very dangerous to skip over it. Because it's only when we've reflected deeply on the truths, the basic truths, impermanence, non-self, dukkha, suffering, dissatisfaction, you know, the conditioned mind, the unconditioned mind. You know, samsara, nirvana. Right. Imprisonment, liberation. Right. We need to reflect deeply so we get it, not just here, but here in the whole body. And when you do that, then your practice will be consistent, enthusiastic, energized. It doesn't mean that there aren't, you know, ups and downs. But the ups and downs are like this. The ups and downs aren't like this. The back and forth is like this. It's not, you know. And the only way you get to that point of steadiness is by deep reflection. Deep reflection on the human condition. You don't have to just read the Dharma. The Dharma points us in a way to look at life. What life? Our life. The life of ourselves, the life of our parents, the life of our children, the life of our friends, the life of our cousins, the life of our neighbors, the life of our, right? The whole human life. Buddha talks about the human condition. If it's true, I was talking to somebody yesterday, the question, I said, you know, if Dharma is true, science will always reaffirm it. If it's not true, then it will not be in concordance with science. But we know one of the exciting things that, you know, a lot of people are into these days is, wow, quantum physics and neuroscience and cognitive sciences are all showing what? That so many of these ancient teachings and understandings about the nature of the mind, you know, we're known thousands of years ago. Just by observing phenomena, observing mind, right? Without instruments, right? But we endlessly invent technologies to reaffirm what? Either our wisdom or our ignorance, to amplify it. Trust in the mind. This mind that knows things just as it is. This mind that everybody here has. but as we have been instructed by the third patriarch, we have to see clearly. I think they're just two very short, simple questions. Humming, singing to the self while walking alone, advised or not? I would not advise it. Again, it's like the question yesterday about guitar playing in the car. There's nothing inherently wrong with it, but we're not here to sing to ourselves. We're here to see clearly the nature of phenomena, the nature of mind. That's all we're here for. We're here to wake up. So it's important. Again, is there anything intrinsically bad about humming to yourself? No. In the vast Buddha mind, humming is fine. It could even be delightful. But we're here. We're here for 7 days to train our minds in a certain way. In that sense, the humming... it's an interference. Listen with your ears to the deepest sounds. Hear the source of the sound. If you're humming, it doesn't work. Flowing like a river as we walk, does it mean flowing on the left or the right foot of the person in front of us, matching their left or right foot, or is it just walking slowly? Again, usually, I don't know, you must have been told this, usually when the person who is leading the walking gets to the front and hits the bell, that is a signal for all of us to begin on our left foot. And that way, the whole group moves together. Sometimes when there are a lot of people in our sangha, it can be very close, and there you really want to be in step. Do you have to be in step? No. But it might be nice to be in step with the person in front of you. But you might step a little differently. It doesn't really matter. So, just to review, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences when love and hate are both absent. Everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is a disease of the mind, and I think that's where we ended yesterday. And now to continue. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential stillness is disturbed to no avail. So if we turn that around, we might say that we are constantly active. Right? We are constantly actively engage in life. And in Buddhism, it's called, we are engaged in the eight worldly dharmas, right? We are engaged in pursuing gain or profit, and we are working hard to avoid loss, right? We are working hard to find pleasure, and we are working very hard to avoid pain. We are working very hard to be liked, and we are working very hard not to be disliked. We are working very hard to be known, to be noticed, to be famous, to be something, and we are working very hard not to be anonymous. We want to be noticed. So those eight, there are all kinds of variations. But quite simply, this is the way most of us are moving through life. And we call that what? normal life. Right? We want to get ahead, we don't want to fall behind. We want to go up, we don't want to go down. We want to be liked, we want to be loved, we don't want to be disliked, we want to be noticed. Right? And whether it is the goals of a lifetime, or whether it's just the way we function on a day-to-day basis at home, in work, you know, this is what we're about. Because consciously or unconsciously, we think if we get the four we want, you know, the four on the positive side, then we will be what? Happy. Everything will be good. We'll be satisfied. And of course, on the ones, the four on the negative side, we think if we, if those happen to us, we will be unhappy. And so we are endlessly, 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 endlessly moving around, blown about by these eight worldly winds. And those are, you know, we could subdivide them. There are probably many, 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 many winds blowing through each of our lives and minds that we are constantly being blown about by. To no avail. To no avail. Why does he say no avail? Because even if things are working on the four upper ones, the four positive ones, that happiness is only, comes, only experienced when we think, when we believe that we've achieved what we wanted. Our expectation has been fulfilled. And then we feel good, happy, but it only lasts a short time. Right? It only lasts a short time. Because it will change. Things will change. Or we'll get bored. Or we'll, check that one off. And then a few days later, a week later, we'll be looking around for something else to check off. That is the nature of this conditioned worldly mind. Right? As well as, you know, we cannot stop what goes up from going down. We cannot stop, you know, we cannot stop profit from also becoming loss. We cannot stop people who like us and love us from disliking us, right? We cannot make everybody notice us. We cannot always be the center of attraction, no matter how funny or clever we think we are, right? And then we feel the pain of losing that, of not being noticed, right? So many people in our, you know, seek pleasure, 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 pleasure. But pleasure, it's only short. And often in the pleasure that people, the way people go about, is pain, is disappointment, is dissatisfaction, even can be addiction. So all that work, and that's hard work, he said, is to no avail. Avail meaning, again, it doesn't achieve the conscious or unconscious purpose of producing real happiness and ease and meaning and goodness in life. And why is that? Why do people do that? He says, because the deep meaning of things is not understood. We look at the ocean and we see the ripples and we think that's all there is. Right? It could look that way, couldn't it? If you're on a boat. Could think, oh, it's, you know, I know the ocean, it's about 3 foot, because I've seen the waves, that's it. They don't know the deep depth of the ocean. If you think the ocean is only, you know, 2 or 3 feet deep, somebody says, come, let's dive in. You say, no, I can't do that, it's just like that thick. It's all I can see. I think that's it. So what is the deep meaning of things? Well, he's saying, I believe, we were talking, because again, this is poetry. This is not, there's no explanation here. The deep meaning of things is that they are empty of any self. That intrinsically, even though things appear to us solid, self-existent, yet there is really nothing like that in anything. Things are just made up of things. Things are just made up of parts. Or we could say things are just interacting processes. Unfolding. But there's nothing solid, permanent, that can be grasped, that can be held on to. When you don't know that, you what? You're always attaching and avoiding. You're always grasping or pushing away. You're always wanting or needing or avoiding, right? Because you don't know the essential meaning of the way things really are. How are things? They just come and go. How are things? They're empty of any self-nature, self-existence. You know, this flower is so beautiful. Look at it. It's got like dew on it or something. Right. This flower in this moment can bring happiness, right? Just by seeing it. But if I leave that understanding that there's nothing there of any permanence or solidity, it just is what it is in the moment, I am able to, in this moment, deeply appreciate it. But I have no need to grab it. I have no need to say, I want it for myself. I want it to last forever. I found finally something that will make me happy. Right? I'm so happy that I found this flower. Right? When the talk's over, I'm going to carry it down. Not let any of you get it, because it's mine, you see. Self is saying, this is mine, right? It's on my table. Somebody gave me that flower, so self goes, it's mine. And just being, having it, knowing it, I am happy, oh so happy. And I take it down. I make sure Ken doesn't get close because I can see he's coveting it, and you know, I want to make sure that nobody else gets what's mine. Take it down to my cabin and I set it out. And then what's going to happen? Well, a number of things are going to happen. First of all, the nature of consciousness and objects is that the excitation that comes to us when we make contact with something and there's a positive response only lasts a short time. So, if I continue to stare at this, what I will notice over time is what? It doesn't quite have the excitement that it had a half an hour ago. So, that will be interesting. It can be frustrating. Be disappointing to me. I could even get a little bored with it. And I think the problem is the flower. No, the problem is my mind. And then, even though the wonderment and excitement of when I first got it isn't there, I still what? Even though I'm getting a little bored, and it doesn't give me quite the kick it did when I found it, I've still appropriated it for who? For me, right? But then over the next couple of days, what's going to happen? It may begin to wilt, lose its color. We call that aging. It's getting older. And then I can really get what? Disappointed. Sad. Why? Is it the flower's fault? No. It's because I had this delusion. Because I was ignorant of the way things really are. I didn't see the deep meaning of the empty, impermanent nature of this. So the individual, the person who wants to live a life of meaning and to live more deeply in life, when they see that occurring, will stop. Right? Will stop and look deeply into what's going on. Look deeply into their own experience. And hopefully draw some very meaningful, important conclusions. But most people do what? Throw it out, on to the next. Right? Just start over again. You know, the mind starts looking around for something new to get excited about, something new to grab onto. Right? Well, it can be flowers, it can be things, it can be toasters, it can be cars, it can be jobs, it can be relationships, it could be music, I mean, you know, endlessly looking for something now. It's endlessly looking. And we wall off that existential disappointment by keeping ourselves busy. By keeping ourselves busy. And when that doesn't work, what do? Right? Or, you know, I'm just using that as an example of many, many things that people do when it's not working. Right? You know, if I can't make happiness myself, then I'll find something to make it for me. And it just gets more and more out of control. Luckily, there is another way. There is another way. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential stillness is disturbed to no avail. The next line says, the way, capital W, is perfect like vast space, where nothing is lacking and nothing is in excess. Indeed, it is due to our choosing to accept or reject that we do not see the true nature of things. So, to help us in the teachings, there are these examples, these similes, these metaphors. The way is like vast space. How is vast space? How is vast space? Vast. How is vast space? No boundaries, right? I mean, well, we'll call this space. This is part of vast space, do you see? Because there's no place where this space ends and another space begins. So this is vast space. Does it have a beginning or end? Does it have an up or down? No. That's why we call it space. Can things move through it freely? Yes. Right. Anything, right? Anybody here can move through space. Right? Rocks can move through space. Spaceships can move through space. Planets can move through space. Right? Baseballs can move through space. Bullets can move through space. Bombs can move through space. Space allows everything to move through it, and it is not disturbed. The great way, the Dharma, the Tao, is like vast space. What is it? It's your own essential mind. Another simile is, we could say our Buddha mind, our true mind, our original mind, and you've heard this before, is like a mirror. Right? The mirror reflects things just as they are. It does not comment. It does not care, right, about what appears before it, does it? That's why this mind is often called mirror mind. It purely reflects what's ever there, whatever appears before it. Right? Right now, it's reflecting you and trees and a lotus and a flower. And it just purely reflects whatever appears before it. It does not comment, does it? Right? Is anybody, you know, that's only in, what's that one? Not Cinderella. You know, Snow White. Only in Snow White does the mirror talk back and comment, right? But is there a mirror in the bathroom? Down below, there's a mirror there. Yeah. Next time you go in there and you look at yourself, well, what you think is yourself. The next time you look in the mirror, please understand that any comment about what is being seen in the mirror is coming from where? From your own rippling, conditioned, the mind that picks and chooses, likes and dislikes. The mirror is totally at your service. It reflects you just as you are, without comment. Right. Is that clear? And also, please note that, let's say, Ken went into the bathroom and he's looking at himself, even though Diane had just left the bathroom, when you look in the mirror, do you see Diane? No. Not a trace of Diane is there. How wonderful this mirror mind. It doesn't hold on to anything. It just reflects what is in the present, in the moment, this wonderful mirror mind of ours. Right? Sights, sounds, thoughts, feelings, perception, all the whole range of experience. This essential mind, original mind, Buddha mind, just reflects. Doesn't hold on to anything. That's our job. We think because we are ignorant and deluded, and without knowing it, cause ourselves to be suffering, to suffer, right? If, think about it, come back to the mirror. Just imagine if everybody who came before it left their imprint. By the time you got in there, you couldn't even see yourself clearly, could you? Because the imprint of all these other people and all these other faces and all these other judgments and ways they thought about themselves, what if that left an impression on that mirror? Would that mirror be able to just purely reflect what it sees right now? No. Everything is distorted. You don't even know what you're seeing. It doesn't even look like you. That's what's happened to our pure original mind, Buddha mind. Is that clear? It's just been covered over with all this endless likes and dislikes, picking and choosing, judgments, evaluations. If you went into the bathroom, Ken wanted to go in the bathroom to kind of comb his hair, you know. Right, because he's very concerned that those hairs be just right, right? I mean, if he went in there and the mirror was just covered with dirt and dust that he couldn't see himself, he'd write a note, wouldn't he? He'd write a note to Chloe, get in there, right? I want to be able to see myself as I am, right? I don't want to have to look in there and see the impressions of everybody else who's been in there, right? I got important things to do, right? We demand perfectly clear mirrors, don't we? And yet, we're willing to accept in our minds minds that are just covered over with endless judgments and evaluations. And not even from the present. I mean, we haul it all, you know, from the past. Right? It's like Ken goes in there and not only is the mirror dirty, but he's brought his own dirt with him. Let me see what I can... And all our minds wants to do is reflect purely and clearly what is being experienced right now. That's all it does. And it's doing it. But rather than looking, rather than listening, rather than tasting, rather than smelling, rather than feeling, rather than just being aware, we endlessly unload projections onto our experience. And we wonder why. You know, our life, our emotions, our feelings, you know, that we don't feel at ease, that we don't feel happy, that we don't feel connected. A lot of people say, I don't feel connected. I want to connect to people. I want to connect to nature. You are already connected to all these things. You just got to stop doing the things that are disconnecting you. Right? This is important. You know, this is very important because a lot of people turn Dharma into something mechanistic. Right? Something I got to do. And if I just got to get it right, just get my practice right, just get the, you know, then. No, that's not what it's about. It's about not doing. The essential clarity and purity and oneness and connection of life and mind is already here. We just need to stop doing it. The mirror is clean. It purely reflects already. If you go in there and it's not reflecting, you just need to clean it. And when you clean it, you will find this pure mirror has always been there. Right? If you go in there and the mirror is not reflecting the way you want, you don't need to get you don't need to get disgusted. You don't need to throw it out. You don't need to go to another bathroom, right, to find another mirror. You just need to what? Get a little Windex. Get a little Dharma. Get a little mindfulness. Spray it on that mind. Clean it up. And that mirror that is always shining brightly and reflecting purely, you will see. The way is perfect like vast space where nothing is lacking and nothing is in excess. You know, we live in a culture where people are always coming from what? Lack. Right? It is a epidemic. And you would think, right, it would be an epidemic of what? Of poor people. Of people who really lack. Right? But it's in our society, everybody lacks, right? Right? From top to bottom. Right? Everybody lacks. If I have a home, I lack a bigger home. If I have a house and a kitchen, I lack a newer kitchen, a more modern kitchen. Right? If I have $1,000, I lack having $2,000. If I'm a millionaire, I lack being a billionaire. Everybody lacks. But also psychologically, people lack. Many people think there's something wrong with them, right? Psychologically, people feel, I lack something. I am less than. I lack. And that state of lacking, of needing, of wanting, is a state of a deep dissatisfaction, unhappiness, anguish, frustration. To feel that you are less than, deficient in some way, that you lack something. And there are those people, on the excess side, feel overwhelmed. Right? Overwhelmed. And so many people say, I'm just overwhelmed these days. So many things to do, so many responsibility. My to-do list is so big. Just overwhelmed. I'm confused, people say. So many excess of choices, excess of thoughts, excess of possibilities. I'm just confused. The way is perfect like vast space, where nothing is lacking and nothing is in excess. Which is it? Could lacking be just a psychological state? Could needing and wanting just be a psychological state? Could all your stories and narratives and perceptions and ideas about who you are and what happened to you and what you lacked and what you need and what you must have and what you're missing and what you can't do is just a story that is only occurring in your mind? And it is just like that that mirror that has all those impressions on it. It is just a distortion of who and what you truly are. Could that be? And that you lack nothing? For example, what does this lack? What does this lack? What is excessive about this? This is you. You're no different than this. This is just this. If you don't compare this to anything, if you don't judge it, if you don't evaluate it, if you don't make up a story about it, this is what? It's just this. And how is it? Perfect. Perfectly what? Perfectly just as it is. It is perfect. Do you think this flower has a problem with its identity? You think this flower is thinking, I am lacking some petals that would even make me more beautiful? Right? Or do you think this flower is thinking, I have too many petals. I'd look so much better with maybe half as many. Do you think this flower is thinking, oh, if I only had another flower just like me here in the vase, my life would be so much happier. Does anybody think that this flower is having those kinds of issues? No, this flower is quite content to be just as it is. It is not even concerned about whether we like it or not. What? It didn't bloom for me, did it? It just bloomed because of that's what it is. That's what it does. It's fulfilling its own inherent purpose and meaning in life. Right? It's not concerned with externalities. It's a sad state when a flower knows more than we do. But we can learn from the flower. They're here to teach us, like the boulders and the stones and the trees, the birds. But we have to look deeply, see deeply, understand deeply. Things are just what they are, and in that they are perfect. Perfectly what? Perfectly themselves. Again, why do we reflect deeply? Why do we practice mindfulness? Why do we meditate? Why do we develop concentration? Why do we reflect? Why do we look deeply and investigate the nature of phenomena and mind? only so we can get this. And you will never get it by thinking it. You don't get out of prison by staying in your cell. You have to open the door and get out. And this is what the practice is, whatever practice you're doing, whatever mindfulness practice, concentration practice, insight practice, reflection, deep reflection, it's about getting out of this self-created world of our own projections, our own thoughts, our own picking and choosing, liking, dislike, the world of preferences at the deepest sense. Do you prefer to be different than you are? You can't be. Give it up. It just causes you suffering, and it's ignorant. You are who you are. Now, if what you think you are is what you are, that's not correct. Because who you are is not your thoughts about who you are. That's a story. And whether that was told to you by others or you made it up yourself, it doesn't matter. It's still a story. You are who you are. And meditation helps you return to your true home. We say that right in the verse. True home isn't somewhere else. Your true home is right here. It is you, but not the you you think you are. Not the you you want to be. Those are all thoughts too. You remember the third patriarch's enlightenment story, right? He came to the second patriarch and he said, "What? I have leprosy. That must mean that I have dirt inside my mind." Right? Only somebody with a dirty mind would be a leper. Right? That's what he said. He was burdened by what? By his thoughts about himself. And the second patriarch said, "Interesting. Show me, look inside. Show me that dirty mind. That's the cause of your leprosy." And in that moment, when Sengsan was willing to turn and look inside his own mind for what he believed was this dirty mind, he couldn't find it. There was nothing there. And in that moment, he was enlightened. Enlightened to what? Enlightened to the true nature of things. That there's no thing. There's no such thing called a dirty mind. You think because of things that happened in the past, need to weigh you down. Things that happened to you in the past are simply memories, stories, images. They don't weigh anything. They don't weigh anything. How can they weigh you down? They only weigh you down if you give them weight. The mind has a great capacity for imagination. Right? It can believe anything. So we can imagine all these things. It doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that these things didn't happen. But it meant the only stain it left is just in the realm of memory, in the realm of words. But in this present moment, it does not exist. that mind of yours that sees that, that mind in which memory appears, story appears, is that mirror. Next time you go into the bathroom, you know what you do by mistake? You look at the image in the mirror, and that's your only concern, right? That face and how it looks. How it looks to who? To you. And how you think it should look or want it to look. Or do your best to make it look. Next time you go in there, notice the mirror. Notice the mirror. You may have a different experience if you don't focus on that face. Look at the mirror that just reflects. Ken was just in there. Don't see a trace of Ken. Just this wonderful reflecting mirror. And any judgment that you may have about that face, it's coming from here. That mirror is quite willing to see you just as you are. Maybe you can begin identifying with the mirror. You might be happier. So this is deep stuff. This is Dharma. This is Dharma in its essence. This is Dharma in its power to liberate. Not to make you more comfortable, right? A lot of us, you know, you heard me say before, a lot of us, you know, we're just, you know, if we can just get out of maximum security and make it to minimum security, you know, we'll be happy, right? And it's absolutely true. If anybody's ever been in maximum, medium, and minimum security, yeah, it is nicer. It's a nicer place. Minimum security rather than maximum security prison. But you're still in prison. You're still in prison. Many people practice Dharma just to get a little more comfortable. That's okay. That's good. I mean, it's good to, you know, work yourself from maximum to minimum if you can. From a certain point of view, that's fine. No one should be faulted. But what if that person in minimum security who's made it from maximum to minimum, if you said to them, well, wouldn't you like to be free? Wouldn't you like to be free? And they say, no, this is good enough for me. It's good enough for me. I'm happy. Things are much better in minimum security. So, in this life, most people just go from minimum to maximum to medium to maximum to minimum to maximum. Right? And maybe if they're lucky, they'll get on probation, but they'll have to wear an ankle bracelet. Report to their probation officer in a regular way. That person is someone who doesn't have a life outside the system. Right? They've learned to work the system, we say. They've learned to game the system so they can get away with a little more. That's the way many people do spiritual practice. But again, like we said the first day, the great way of liberation is available to all of us. But it's a choice. It's a choice. Is my goal in life just to get from maximum to minimum? Or do I want out? And again, I'm using geographic, physical, but this is not. There's nothing physical. samsara, nirvana, the world of suffering and the world of non-suffering, is right here. The experience of suffering and the experience of non-suffering occurs in your own mind. It's not about externals. So this needs to be reflected deeply on. Please spend some time while you're on retreat reflecting deeply. Again, on your aspiration. And again, from the point of view of maximum security, getting to medium security is what? Good. Getting from medium to minimum? Good. Being on probation, having to, you know, be in by nine and always having your ankle bracelet and reporting to your probation officer. Right? It's better than minimum security. And yet, there is another way. And because I want to finish this page today, live neither in the entanglement of outer things nor in inner feelings of emptiness. Be serene in the oneness of things, and such erroneous views will disappear by themselves. And again, I think what's being referred to here. Let's see how other people translate that. In this translation, it says, do not pursue conditioned existence, do not abide in acceptance of emptiness, in oneness and equality. Confusion vanishes of itself. Outside, don't get entangled, don't get tangled in things. Inside, don't get lost in emptiness. Be still and become one, and it all stops by itself. Be seduced neither by the outer world nor by your inner emptiness. Reside in the oneness of things, where distinctions are meaningless. So again, different translators look at it differently. So if we want to talk about outer things, we're talking about what? All phenomena, right? All the activities, the people, places, things that we're involved in, right? The world of things. Life. He says, don't get entangled. Entangled, when you're entangled in something, what? You can't move freely, can you? You're kind of tied. You're kind of knotted. You're caught when you're entangled. So he says, what he's talking about again is life. Life, relationships, the ups and downs. You know, remember the eight worldly winds, the ups and downs, the fame and ignominy, the pleasure, pain. He said, you know, that whole thing. And it gets much more intricate, right? The entanglements of life. We get entangled at work. We get entangled at home. We get entangled in society. We get entangled with ourselves. Just endlessly kind of taking these strands of life and just, rather than just letting them be open and free, we what? We just tie endless knots. And we tie ourselves to it. And no wonder we don't feel light. No wonder we don't feel free. No wonder, right? No wonder we don't have that lightness of being, that openness, that sense of freedom. Because we are entangled in what? Because we make a big deal about everything. And we just can't, you know, we can't do anything without tying a little knot. And it's all around one. Picking and choosing, preferences, wanting to be this way, not wanting to be that way. Right? We endlessly tie ourselves in knots. We get entangled in the world of things, the world of conditioning. Right? But he also says, you know, but don't go the other way either. You know, and here when he talks about void, he's not talking about shunyata or emptiness. He's talking about, you know, I think he's referring to one could go, all right, I'm not going to get entangled. I'm just going to stay home. Right? Little, what could you say? Bored, little alienated, kind of empty feeling inside, you know. It's not a good feeling. But at least I'm not entangled in all that stuff, right? Because every time I go out there, it just turns me around, turns me that world, right? So I'm going to stay home and just stay in my own little inner void, my own little empty feelings. But it's safe. Is that clear? He's saying, live neither in the entanglement of things nor in inner feelings of emptiness. Again, these are emptiness, not of what we talk about in Dharma of emptiness. Be serene in the oneness of things, and such erroneous views will disappear by themselves. And again, I think we've spent a lot of time talking about that today. About how to live in the oneness of things, of living in the world where we just accept things just as they are. Right? And we move through the world reflecting what's happening right now and not grasping, clinging, attaching, avoiding, picking, choosing. We're open. An open mind, a spacious mind, right? Spacious mind means things can come and go, right? Thoughts can come and go, good thoughts can come and go, bad thoughts can come and go, high thoughts can come and go, low thoughts can come. There's room for everything to come and go, right? But we don't grab onto any of it. It's no big deal, right? Space does not get concerned about what's moving through it. The mirror just reflects purely, without comment, on whatever appears before, and it does a fine job. Just reflecting. So here in retreat, kind of away from our worldly entanglements, we have an opportunity to observe the processes and activities of our minds with a different kind of background. So if you are not at ease, if your mind is not open and fresh and at ease, it is because why? Because somehow, even here, we've got ourselves tangled up. Right. Or if we haven't gotten ourselves tangled up, we've gotten ourselves a little bit into that inner voidness, inner kind of emptiness. Kind of boring, dull. That's a wonderful thing going on retreat. That's a wonderful thing about sitting in meditation. You know, retreat, we can't go out. We're stuck. When we're on the cushion, not only are we stuck on a retreat, but we're stuck in a specific place, and no matter what we're feeling or experiencing, we're not allowed to leave and move. How wonderful. We are forced to face ourselves. to deal with our minds, to deal with our condition. Again, not to bemoan, right? Not to be frustrated, not to be disgusted, but to understand. Right? We don't just sit down on the cushion not knowing what we're doing. We sit down on the cushion having Dharma, the teachings and the practices of Dharma at hand. So we know how to heal and transform whatever is arising. If you do not know how to heal and transform whatever is arising, if you don't know what your practice is, please ask me. That's why we meet. So you're clear what you should be doing, how to apply the teachings and the practices, so you're not just sitting there mulling over, reinforcing, continuing to create and recreate your suffering. Right. That's not a good use of this time, is it? We do that, we could go down to Asheville for that. But everybody here is taken time from their life, have come up from the cities and the towns to come to this pure place of practice. So don't waste this wonderful opportunity to just continue the same narrative, whatever your narrative is, whatever your story is. If you just sit around and continue it, you're just reinforcing. Again, the teachings and the practices are to be applied when you're sitting, when you're walking, wherever you are. You should know what you should be doing with your mind. You should know how to deal with the phenomena that's arising. Okay? And not to do it in the old way. So again, if you don't know, and if you're not having your meeting with me till tomorrow or something, put a note in the bell. But everybody should be clear that they're not here just to repeat the same stuff. Is that clear? This is, again, precious time to come on retreat like this. Days are beautiful, setting's beautiful, weather's beautiful, right? We do not know when we'll be here again. We do not know if we'll have this kind of opportunity again, right? We think we do, because we are what? Deluded. We think things are permanent, and that things will always, and but it's not that way. All we know is that we are here now, and this opportunity is now. And so please don't waste it, reifying old patterns, continuing old narratives and dialogues with yourself. That, as the third patriarch say, are for no avail. They don't produce any goodness. They don't produce insight. And so we'll stop here.